I know you worked on Halley for a while. I'll leave that out for the time being because there's so much I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Talk about the... clearly what stands out in your memory are some of the major events, such as the transatlantic expedition.
Oh, yeah, the TIA.
What was so special about that for you?
That it was ours. It was British.
You weren't directly involved?
No, not in the door, not in the least.
What were the ripples that reached you then? What was
Sir Vivian Fuchs was going to doing the TA, and we used to listen to it on the radio and think, what I used to think was, this is good for Bass. Because when I joined the British Antarctic Survey, or FIDS, it was nobody knew what you were doing. Nobody had heard about it. They had this office in Victoria, was it, in London? And it wasn't anything like as large as it is today. It was a tiny organisation. And that's what I liked about it. There was a handful of people, maybe... you know, in London office, maybe 10, and you knew them all, and it was like a sort of family, and you could talk to them all. Sir Vivian Fuchs are very approachable, and you could always get things done by discussion and reasoning. There was a Derek Gipps and a Bill Sloman, who I knew quite well, on the staff. They used to... wangle things. And when the TAE started, when Sir Vivian went on the TAE, I thought, that's good. That's, you know, the British are going to do it, and he'll get publicity. It'll be in the papers, on the radio. We used to listen to it in Sydney and listen on the radio and say, where is he now? Is he going to do
on
it?
On the Goon Show, you know?
It used to come up on the BBC as well.
The proper radio,
yeah. The Goon Show, yes, they did discuss details like that, and the fact that Sir Edmund Hillary had driven a tractor there first and had been a bit critical.
So the average FID was quite excited, was he, by what Fuchs
was slightly interested, I thought there wasn't not really quite enough interest amongst the FIDs, but our base was. We used to say, well, how are they doing? What's the latest on the TAE? And I even bought the first day cover stamps with the TAE. Yeah.
You also mentioned the signing of the SCAR Treaty, which you regard to be a scientific committee on Antarctic research.
Yes.
What was so significant about that for you as an ordinary?
Right, okay. Well, when I first went to Deception, I was in charge of Chandlery, and in the workshop there was a zinc stencil and a brush and some black paint and so on, and it said British Crown Territories, and it was one of us was supposed to put notices up, and you know, every so often round Deception and wherever we were, a note saying, this is British Crown Territory, beware, you know, you're trespassing if you're a foreigner. And so I said to George Hemmen, is this a joke or is this serious? And he said, oh, this is serious, yeah. You're supposed to put this notice up to keep the Chileans and the Argentinians in their place, you see. And I said, but they're only human like us, you know. Because when they came across, when the Argentines came over to meet us in a social way, they had a doctor and a base leader and a senior met and so on, and they spoke English, spoke very good English. And I thought, you know, why can't we get along with these people? Incidentally, thought they were not very worthy citizens, and he used to refer to them derogatory, and I used to say, oh, you know, that's ridiculous, you know, they're only like us and we're all working in the Antarctic, and you know, why should you dislike them because they're another nation? So when the SCAR Treaty was signed, I thought, thank heaven for that. And the IGY was the first time that all nations had actually got together under the same roof and were working on a project. Although it was probably meaningless, at least it showed that we could get together and you didn't have these silly little squabbles. And so when they signed the SCAR Treaty, that the Antarctic was you're not going to test weapons or exploit the minerals, that it would be left as the Antarctic, and if necessary, clean out all the rubbish that we'd left there. I thought, well, that, you know, nobody could object to that. That's a good move. But when they started saying, well, the dogs have got to go as well, and you say, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, it's bound to affect you that way. Whereas the gasoline skidoo is not really as good as the dogs.
Do you think that the SCAR was watertight at that point?
It appeared to be.
There are no loopholes or gaps?
I was unaware of them. Mm. Are there gaps?
No, I'm just asking.
Well, I was unaware. I thought anybody who sensibly read the document and then signed it was a bona fide member of the society. Mm. And it's such a large area. You know, why shouldn't you have more than one nation showing interest in the area?
Were you sorry to see the dogs go?
Well, they didn't disappear when I was down there, but yes, in a way, but it is inevitable that they came from the other end of the world to get to the Antarctic. They came from the Arctic to the Antarctic, and although, you know, they are a natural way of, or a good way of getting around, dog sledging is a good way of getting around in the Antarctic, you get a good response from dogs, which you don't get from any other piece of gasoline equipment. Mm. You know, the tractor never shows that it's pleased to see you, or the skidoo.
You were amongst the first men to try the skidoos, weren't you, when you were at Halley in the 60s or 70s?
Yeah, 60s. Yeah, 67, so, wouldn't
apart
it?
From the fact they didn't wag their tails, how did you take to the skidoos?
Well, I thought it was... I wouldn't like to have driven one because with the dog sledge you get behind and you're pushing and you're running and you're doing things and you're expending a fair bit of energy and at least you stay warm. Whereas if you're sitting behind sitting behind a screen and pushing, pulling, or steering with a steering wheel, it's got to be a cold pursuit. It's like the sledge, skidoo as well. And, you know, when they found at Halley Bay, when you tow a sledge, that if you can't get all the men in the skidoo, if you can't get all the men in the muskeg, somebody has to sit out at the back, and he's the poor bugger who gets all the snow falling on him and gets damn cold for a while, unless he's prepared to run. But he was the sole survivor at that incident when the muskeg went down the crevasse, the man on the back of the sledge.
Was that on your watch or...?
No, that was... I'm not quite sure what year that was, 64 or something like that. The skidoo. Now, one of my experiences with the skidoo was really quite funny, really. I noticed quite early on that the skidoo has got its skis out to the side and very low centre of gravity, because your motor's down there, and it's got a friction clutch. In other words, the faster the revs on the engine, the better grip the clutch has got, because it's centrifugal. And this centrifugal clutch, you don't operate by a lever, but it's just by the revs of the engine. And we had an incident at Halley Bay when I was talking to Ricky Chin, and we heard the muskeg come in, and I said, oh, this is Joe Porter. He's just been up to the other base and he's brought back that spanner that I want, or whatever it was, that piece of equipment that I want. And as we were talking, this skidoo went past the door, empty, and carried on out into space, you know, carried on out into the Bundoo. So eventually Joe Porter turned up and I said, was that your skidoo that's disappeared out there forever? And he said, yeah. He said, I do feel bloody silly, but I was going over some sastrugi and it tipped me on the side. And while it was on its side, I fell out. And while I was pulling myself together, it kind of righted itself and went off, you see, because it was the engine was running so fast, the clutch was gripping. And he said, I ran after it, but it was going just a bit faster than I could run, so I couldn't overtake it and stop it. So I just said, no, to hell with it. You know, I don't know what to do now, but I feel a proper burk because this thing has made me look damn silly. And because he apologised to Ricky, Ricky was furious. And I couldn't see why Ricky was so furious, because to me it seemed like a funny incident.
Ricky Chin.
Ricky Chin. But then Ricky is...
What happened to the skidoo in the end?
Right, well, by some strange coincidence, I went to a reunion at Cambridge, and Ricky was there, and we were talking, and there was a skidoo that people were looking at going around, and I sat on this skidoo, and I said, you know, these things, they're weird, aren't they? They've got a very low centre of gravity, and they kind of right themselves like King Tut, And I said, yeah, I wonder what ever happened to the one that Joe Porter... I said, you know, as far as we're concerned, it just went on forever, ran out of fuel, and that's it. And a fellow there who was a civil engineer while I was down there, or he was a glaciologist, shall I say, while I was down there, but he's working for a civil engineer now, he said, oh, no, it was found. It ran out of fuel, and it was over on such and such a place... And he mentioned the place. And I said, how did they find it? And he said, just a sheer fluke. Somebody saw this spot over there in the distance and trained the binoculars on it. Oh, that's a skidoo. And they decided to go and get it.
Were they modified after that to stop them from running off?
They should have been, shouldn't they?
You don't know.
I don't think so.
Okay. Right. Let's talk about, whilst we're talking about Halley, let's talk about this evacuation of John... Brotherhood.
Oh, Brotherhood, yeah.
The doctor.
Dr. Brode.
What actually happened? I mean, I have heard other accounts of this, but I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah.
What actually happened to him?
What happened to him? Mm. We fell off this. We were doing the circuitous route.
He was doing human physiology tests, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, that's right.
What was he doing?
It's oxygen and CO2, you know, how much energy you expend or something. This was his program, human physiology. You had to wear a piece of gear over your head, and he was trying to measure how much oxygen you absorbed and CO2 you expired, and he'd take your weight periodically. I think it was on a daily basis, and your food intake. And he was trying to relate one to the other. And, of course, with this thing over your face, with this hood on, and he's measuring your breath, we knew it was a whiteout condition, or at least I knew it was a whiteout condition, and I was not very happy about doing this circuit. But, however, I knew it had to be, because everybody else had been worked on. And I said, OK, come on then, let's do it now and then get it over and done with. When we got to the ramp down onto the sea ice to complete the circuit, we got disorientated and I took my hood off and so had Bro, and we were standing looking around and trying to get our bearings and saying, where the devil are we then? And Bro said, I think that drum over there marks the route down to the sea ice, you see. That's the ramp, surely. And we were looking at this, and then the cliff that we were standing on, or this bit of snow we were standing on, gave way, and we just fell down onto what was the sea ice underneath, and or broken it was, because I dare say that the Cornish edge bits had fallen down onto the sea ice below and made a few pinnacles, because as I fell, one leg went down into softer snow and the other one stayed on the surface, whereas he was unfortunate. As he landed, he doubled up, and one of his knees hit him right full in the face. And we both took a little bit of time to recover, and I said to Bro, "How are you?" And he said, "Oh, fuck," he says, "I'm not too good. How are you?" And I said, "Well, I've done something to my ankle, but I'm not sure what. How are you?" You see, and he said, "Not too." I said, "Crikey, your face is a bit of a mess, isn't it?" You know, he'd put his teeth through right through his lip, and I said, "Right, you're the medical man. What do you recommend? What do you think?" And he said, "Well, we can't make it back to base like this." And I said, "No, so I'll pitch the tent, get you inside, and, you know, get a meal going or whatever else. And we'll just, since we've got no radio, we'll just have to wait, because they know where we are on base. We'll just have to wait for somebody to come and get us if the weather improves." So Bro was saying, "If you open the medical kit, you'll find this." And he was giving me instructions on, you know, what you should do. And he said, "It's not serious. This isn't serious. It's only my teeth gone through my lip." And he didn't look too good, I'll say that. But, you know, I said, "Well, we'll get you in your sleeping bag." So we got the tent round him, or got the tent up and dragged him in and stuck him in his bag and so on. And then we just lay up there for a day or so, and then...
Because the weather was against you?
It was against us, and I knew nobody would come out looking for us because the whiteout condition had got even worse. It's whiteout is where you've got no blue sky, you see, and this got even worse, so kind of surface drift and totally overcast. But the first bit of blue sky, we heard a voice, somebody saying, "There they are," and it was Dave... What's he called? John Galsworthy and David, the carpenter fellow that we took with us. He spotted us, and then eventually they got a skidoo and took Bro back to base, you see, and me, took us both back to base. He was, you know, Ricky had obviously been in touch with London, and Sir Vivian, and said, you know, put the situation to him, and he asked for help from Pole Station.
Who decided that Brotherhood had to be evacuated?
I should think London office, or, yeah, I should have thought.
His injuries were quite serious then?
It was his back was the problem,
right, okay.
I think, because he kept saying, "I think I've damaged my spine."
Right, OK, I understand.
And as far as I was concerned, it was all this round his face because he hit. Mm. And I thought, well, you know, whatever he'd done to his back, it must have been just the pain or whatever.
How was he the airlift done? What happened?
The Americans flew over and we tried to indicate wind direction to them. They brought over a... Hercules, and we made a gadget to fire cocoa into the air and create a cloud of dust that would drift downwind to indicate the wind direction to them. Anyway, they it's such a large craft, it just came and landed. It didn't need really much about the weather. It just came and landed, and that was it. You had Americans everywhere. They came in all their polar gear and Christ or else. And some of our fellows were wearing just stuff like this. And they still had their duvets and heaven knows what else, big gloves in the hut. they were really quite amused. They don't look at it the way we do. They're sent. They don't volunteer to go and go to the Antarctic and with... You know, with an aim in mind, they're servicemen and they're doing their stint.
So the air rescue was actually organised quite swiftly and quite efficiently?
It was quite swiftly. They took him on a sledge out to the aircraft and loaded him aboard.
To New Zealand?
And he went to New Zealand. I don't think it was non-stop to Wellington, but it would be... Where would they refuel?
Did you get a replacement doctor?
No.
So how did you cope?
Nobody was ill. Without a doctor? Without a doctor who didn't have a doctor at Fossil Bluff. Or a dentist. Mm. And nobody was ill.
The other accident I'd like you to tell me about is it concerns...
George.
Yeah, George.
George and Ralph Horne.
Oh, right.
Yeah, George McLeod. Right. Well, this was a notorious occasion. We went to Fossil Bluff. And George is a mountaineer. And he's very hardy and he's very resourceful. Tough and resourceful. Excellent fella. Whereas Ralph Horne is the geologist. Different sort of fellow altogether, but he needed a general assistant to look after him in the field. So I was at Fossil Bluff, and you turn on the radio at specific times during the day, turned on the radio and said, can you hear me, Ralph, or anything like that? And or this voice came in and interrupted and said, you know, is that you? Is that Fossil Bluff? And I said, yes, it is. And he said, oh, it's Ralph Horne here. In his just chatty sort of way. And I said, oh, yeah, what's up, Ralph? And he said, George has fallen down a hole, you see. I said, oh, really? What, down a crevasse? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, my goodness, has he hurt? And he says, I don't know. And I said, have you shouted down the hole to him? Can you see him? And I said, come, give me some details, you see. So he was trying to get a few details, and he then said over the radio, said, we might need help. And I said, I'll come out immediately. I'll just down everything and I'll load up the sledge and I'll come out. And I said, you know, where are you? And he gave me the direction and where he was. So he got out there, and of course before I got there, George had shown a bit of resourcefulness,
yeah,
and had urinated on his gloves and pushed them onto the ice cliff and used that to climb up the side of this crevasse and climbed out himself.
I'm not quite clear. So you wee on your gloves?
You wee on your gloves, which makes them wet.
Yeah.
And he then he got up as high as he possibly could and then he forced them onto the ice cliff, onto the ice, and then he said, then he used that with just sufficient leverage to pull himself up and to lift himself out the hole, because by the time I got there, he was out.
Was that part of the classic crevasse rescue training of the day, or was that just him going?
Well, I think he'd actually heard of the story of John Cunningham with Duncan Cass on South Georgia, on the South Georgia expedition, where he lifted himself out of a crevasse. John Cunningham did, by similar technique.
So and a legend came to the rescue.
It was a legend, yeah. And so George McLeod must have said, well, if it did it for one, it must do it for another. So it stuck just enough. Not hard, but like a bit of super glue.
So he was already out when he got there?
So he was already out, but he was kind of sitting, looking, unlike George, not so perky as he usually is. And I said, crikey, I was going to pull you out of the hole. And he said, yes, I managed to get out on my own, you see. And I said, yeah, I can see that. I said, right, there's only one thing I can do. I'll take you back to base and you can, we'll get you out as fast as we can. We'll fly you out. I said, but the problem is we've got no aircraft. We can't sort of fly you out to get you help. But anyway, if you rest up at base, you'll start to feel a bit better. So I said to George, if I put you in your sleeping bag on the sledge and tie you down there a bit, we'll go off to base, you see. And so my dogs were looking kind of frisky and leaping around and making all sorts of noises, and I just went click with my one ski, just did one click, which they must have thought was the order to go, and they all leapt forward and pulled to pick it out and went. And I was shouting, stop, or words to that effect, not stop. I was shouting in whatever the language to stop them.
Yeah.
And they took no notice. They just carried on running. Whereas George then had to wriggle out of the sleeping bag and apply the brake. And that's when he said to, oh, you know, I walked up there, Christ, I'll murder you. The dogs. And I was so angry I was going to murder them all. And I was cursing the dogs from half a mile away. And George said, yeah, don't make me laugh. Whatever you do, don't make me laugh. So
and he was about his ribs, wasn't he? Yes.
He damaged his ribs. I don't know whether he broke them or just bruised them, but he was in agony if he inhaled a deep breath and so on. So I had to get him to base. But that was really quite funny.
How was he treated? Was he sent away or was he treated on base?
He stayed on base until eventually an aircraft took him away, I think aircraft, and took the dogs as well up to Adelaide and then away. I haven't seen him since. I think that was our last time we ever spoke.
There's a couple more things to ask you about.
Yeah.
Before we stop. This story about flying with an Argentinian pilot to Stanley Racecourse.
Oh.
I mean, first of all, what on earth are you doing sharing a plane with an Argentinian pilot?
No, what does that say? Flying with an...
Once when Jim Shercliffe was flying with an Argentinian pilot in a small aircraft to the Falklands, they managed to land on Stanley Racecourse.
He did? No. What it was, I was working in Stanley, and Sadie Clements, I was living at Sadie's and Clem's house, she worked in Bass office, and she came home and said, you know, we've had telephone calls from the West Falklands all morning long that there's an aircraft flying over the west. And while we were sitting having lunch, we heard this little aircraft come over, and she said, that must be them, it must be him. And so what he did, he landed his aircraft on the race course and put a Argentinian flag and protest notes and heaven knows what else he tied onto a fence there, and he was getting back in his aircraft, and he was still in his aircraft. He'd got back in his aircraft and was getting ready to take off, having left his protest. And I, meanwhile, had run all the way from Clem's out to the race course and down and across to the aircraft. And I said to him, are you having some sort of difficulty or other? You in trouble? And he said, I've left my protest over there, you see. And I said, you know, what's it all about, you know, really? What's going on? And he said, in broken English, that he was going, he was off. He'd done what he'd come to do. He'd left his protest note. And so I was at a loss, really. What do you do to a fellow? I could have scrambled in the aircraft alongside him or whatever, sabotaged his aircraft, but what if I was in the wrong? That I'd deliberately caused damage. Anyway, a few things entered my mind, and I thought, well, you know, what's to stop him just going? And he told me his name was Fitzgerald. And he obviously got Irish blood in his veins somewhere, and he just took off and flew back to the Argentine. And it did occur to me since, you know, what if I'd actually dragged him out and...
Arrested him.
Mm. Would there have been a war? Would
what,
it have...
What year was this?
It's got to be in the 60s, hasn't it? The year of the... When the C4 was taken across to the race course, and they spent a few miserable nights out in the open, didn't they? The Condor Commandos. Mm. What year was that? That was the 60s, wasn't it?
So you let him go again?
I had to let him go, yeah. Yeah, I didn't fly with him. whatever the report says.
Well, it's Norfolk Museum's website.
So oh, was it? Oh, Norfolk Museum. Oh, dear. Slightly incorrect. A twisted, slightly incorrect, yeah.
Never believe everything you read on.
No, or see sometimes.
You eventually left Bass.
Yeah.
And I don't know quite when that was, but I guess that's going to be in the 70s. After a couple of seasons at Halley.
Yeah.
Working on Halley 2.
Yeah.
And you went to do a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Sciences.
Yes, Environmental Engineering, yeah.
Where was that?
That was the Masters.
Yeah.
Is this?
No, but Bachelor of Science.
Oh, the BSc at UMIST in Manchester. That was...
What led you to do that?
Well, the hut at Stonington was designed by a man at Crown Agents called Baldwin, and we got quite chummy, and Colin Baldwin and I we got along very well together. In fact, Bass took him down to the Antarctic just to let him see what sort of conditions he was designing his buildings for, because I thought that the grillage, I thought was just a waste of money. Because when I went to school, we did an experiment, regulation, which is a wire cutting through a chunk of ice, and then the ice is still together when you cut right through with your wire, which is all to do with the melting point of water and the pressure you apply. And so he said, Colin said, why are you against the grillage? And I said, well, this problem of regulation is not going to go away. The weight of the hut will push the grillage slowly down. And he said, you should get yourself a few qualifications and come and join me in the office, you see. And I said, yeah, that would suit me, actually, to work in the Crown Agents. I said, when I go to England, I'll take a national diploma or national certificate and see what happens. So I went to Brixton School of Building, and at Brixton they said, why don't you go on and take a degree in the subject? And that's when I thought, I hadn't really planned this, but, there's no reason why I shouldn't give it a try. And so I did. I went the whole hog, and we went to Manchester and I took my degree.
This wasn't building science, this was environmental science, was it?
It is building. It was building technology. And the environmental engineering was my master's degree, which I did in London later.
Right.
And environmental engineering is heating, lighting, ventilation or air conditioning. Anything that man does to create an environment which is habitable.
So having learned how to build huts in the Antarctic, you then
found out, got the
qualifications to do it elsewhere.
I got the qualifications later to say that you were getting it right. Yeah, I'm given another few years.
I'm sorry, I understood it was environmental science, which I thought was to do with biology and...
Oh, no.
And ecology.
No.
Building science.
No, okay. It's building science. Building science and technology. In fact, one of my qualifications is AMIST, that's an associate member of the Institute of Science and Technology.
And did that shape your future career then?
Yes, it did. Yeah, because I got married and my wife was teaching, and the building industry was pretty badly affected at the time. They were paying people off, and so I went into teaching. And I found that quite easy at the start, because I suppose it came too easy, it was too natural in a way, that, having done some building and learnt from being on the spot doing it, you then go and look at it scientifically or perhaps rationally and say, what did I do wrong? Or what did we do right? Well, building in England is different from building down there, because you use bricks and mortar here, and you have a rising damp problem here, whereas in the Antarctic you hopefully you build to last. In many cases you do. The damp proof course, which you introduce into bricks here, you down there you put it under your timber support, but it still goes that if you lift everything out the ground and you're not in contact with the ground, the timber has got an opportunity to dry out. You can prolong the life of the huts. Incidentally, my job at Bass was never a permanent job. It was always the building officer or the officer in charge of building would only get a job if they were thinking of building something.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was nothing coming up in your department, they wouldn't renew your contract.
Now you're almost 78.
Yeah.
How do you look back onto your Bass years now, your FID years? Are they, how would you rate them in over your 78 years of experience?
Interesting. I think my years spent with Bass, God, I learnt so much. I must have been awfully green when I first went down. Because I was born in Middlesex and educated in London, I didn't really know anything that was as wild as Stanley and the Antarctic till I actually got there. And it's the amazing thing is that you can adapt yourself and cope with it all and learn lots of tricks while you're down there, learn what's right and not give up.
You learned to cook, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, I still do, really. George Hammond said to me, when I first went to Deception, you're on Cook next week. I said, oh, OK. Yeah, thinking that you open a few cans and warm it up and so on. And he said, oh, on Monday we want some bread. And I said, bread? Bread? But you buy that, don't you, bread? How do you make bread then, for heaven's sake? And he said, oh, it's on the... All the instructions are on the bag of flour. And I said, show me a bag of flour then. Where are these instructions? And so there he gets this bag of flour and it says, if you're going to make a loaf of bread, this is what you have to do. And I thought, God, crikey, I've got to do all this. And put the yeast in and keep it, nurture it and keep it warm and make it, and you keep proving it. And anyway, eventually I thought, what I've got to do, I've got to learn how to do this really well. And I can compare my performance with other people's. And Lance Tickell and I sometimes used to compete about who could make the best rolls. And Peter Caudle. And I got to make a decent loaf of bread and rolls and whatever. And a meal. And I used to cook penguins and things like that, bits of seal meat and penguins. I got quite proud of the fact that I could... I could knock out a meal.
It's lunchtime, Jim.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Shall I knock out a meal?
Yeah.